You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk about images that represent hope and how the city of Appleton is trying to promote hopeful photos in a new contest. Now, the U.S. may be in for a record-setting week in terms of COVID-19 cases and deaths. CNBC did some number crunching using data from Johns Hopkins University. They found that over the past 7 days, America has reported a record-high daily average of more than 196,000 cases. That's up more than 20% from a week before. If the trend continues, it'll likely top 200,000 this week. In terms of deaths over the past week, roughly 2,200 were reported per day on average. That essentially matches the record weekly average set in late April. Just recently, a record 2,900 Americans died in a single day. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar addressed the spike on Fox News Sunday.
We're seeing the surge in cases in the United States, but also in Germany, France, UK, Spain. It's about behavior and cold weather. People are going indoors. They're not minding the three W's. They're not wearing their face coverings. We're engaged in indoor behaviors where we let our guard down. We need people to renew their commitment.
The three W's there: wear a mask, wash your hands, and watch your distance. The figures come as strict new lockdowns go into effect in California. Meanwhile, many governors have reinstated safety precautions in recent weeks, including halting in-person classes and limiting indoor and outdoor dining at restaurants. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How are you feeling about where the U.S. stands when it comes to COVID? Are you worried about it, not worried about it? What would you like to see policymakers do about it at the federal or state levels? Do you think states need to do full-on lockdowns, or are there particular restrictions you'd like to see in place? Are you planning on getting a COVID vaccine as soon as you're able? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Reed Wilson is a correspondent at The Hill and author of Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. Reed, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, for a long time, we were talking about where the hotspots were in the United States. Is that a meaningful phrase anymore, given how widespread this is? Do we still have hotspots, or are we kind of all a hotspot at this point?
Yeah, it is a hot nation at the moment, and not in a good way. The numbers of cases that began to rise with this third wave that started spreading in the upper Midwest and started really focusing on Wisconsin has now radiated all the way around the country. Even the states that have historically done pretty well in keeping this the infection in check are now seeing rising case counts. Basically, the only place where the outbreak is not completely uncontrolled is Hawaii. And last time I checked, they got about 2,500 miles of water to protect them.
Is there any evidence that this current surge has anything to do with the Thanksgiving holiday? I know we're just 10 days out from it. Things can kind of lag after an event, but I know there's concern about a lot of gatherings on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked that, because I spent this afternoon reporting that very question. And it looks like we're starting to see the beginning of a Thanksgiving surge. And let me tell you why. As I look at a state like Wisconsin, there was actually some progress being made. As I'm looking at week over week case counts, you know, by early November, you were at 32,000. By mid-November, it was up to 48,000. And that was the apex at November 15th, and we started to see the cases coming down, 46,000 the following week, 32 the following week. But now that fall has plateaued at 32,000 cases. I'm really worried what we're going to start seeing in the next week as more people begin to get sick.
Now,
there are a lot of other states where we the number of and then go up again, or where we saw the cases start to fall off and then go up again a little bit too. So I'm pretty nervous about the next week.
And my worry, Reed, when we saw good numbers in Wisconsin, it was a couple weeks after we had this stretch, a long period of time of, you know, 60, 70 degree weather, weirdly, in the fall, allowing people to get outside, open windows. I mean, can it be something as small as that, a good burst of weather, giving us at least a temporary respite from transmission of the disease?
Well, we would hope so, but it would have to be approximately 2 weeks long to make a meaningful dent in the amount of transmission. And we'd really have to see a huge number of people following all of the recommendations that these health experts have been telling us again and again, hammering into our brains. And you know, frankly, we're in the midst of pandemic fatigue. It's been, 9 months? We're all exhausted. We all want to go outside. We all want to return to some kind of normal. But the fact is, the virus isn't isn't done. Like, the virus doesn't go away just because we're ready to be done with it. We still need to
there. Break it up a little bit there. Reed Wilson is with us. We're going to reconnect. Reed is a correspondent at The Hill, author of the book Epidemic, Ebola and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. We are talking about what's going on with COVID-19 around the country, what different states are doing or not doing to try to stop the spread of the illness. We'll get in a little bit to vaccines and the road to vaccines in just a bit. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions on the latest news, and what, if anything, you'd like to see at the state level or federal level when it comes to controlling the spread of the illness. Reed, let's talk a little bit about vaccines. That's the hopeful light at the end of the tunnel. What are we seeing when it comes to the prospects for a rollout of vaccines over the coming months?
I think in these dark moments, we should pause and recognize just what an incredible achievement the two main vaccines that are in the pipeline really have been. They came out of nothing. I mean, we didn't know, you know, that a novel coronavirus was out there back in January, and they are now on the brink of being rolled out. And these vaccines, I got to say, I spent some time looking into them, are incredible. They're built on a structure called mRNA, the messenger RNA virus, and effectively what they do is they teach your body to look out for the spike protein. If anybody's seen a picture of the coronavirus, you know those little red spikes that come off it. Mm-hmm. Those little spikes are the way that the virus gets into your cell in the first place. So these vaccines teach your body to look for that specific protein and go after it the moment you see it. The really incredible thing about this mRNA technique is that they don't use any live virus. So, you know, in a flu vaccine or something, you know, one in a million people might have an adverse reaction or might get some live virus or something like that. There's no possibility of that in these vaccines. So it's really just a tremendous achievement in science. And if you don't know the names of the people who invented this technique at the National Institutes of Health, you'll know them when they win their Nobel Prize in very short order.
Last week, Robert Redfield, director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, acknowledged the vaccines, but said, in effect, let's not take our foot off the gas now. Here's a listen.
We now begin to turn the corner with the vaccine. But the reality is December and January and February are going to be rough times. I actually believe they're going to be the most difficult time in the public health history of this nation.
Can you talk about that prediction before we really get these vaccines up and running, the difficulties we're going to see over the next few months, Reed?
Right. So we're going to see these difficulties because this is a virus that takes time to manifest itself. It takes a few weeks for somebody, up to 2 weeks, for somebody to show signs of infection once they've gotten the virus. Then if things go badly for them, it's probably another week and a half or 2 weeks before they end up in the hospital. And then it's another week or so, hopefully, if they resolve and get to leave the hospital. But unfortunately, there is a percentage of people who will not come out of the hospital. And that takes time. So basically what we're seeing now, the people who go into the hospital today were infected 2 weeks ago. The people who are on ventilators today were infected probably 3 or 4 weeks ago. So imagine where we are now and extrapolate that into the future. And effectively, we've got a Christmas holiday right around the corner after Thanksgiving when all of us traveled. Well, I didn't travel. I hope nobody else did too. But a lot of people traveled around the country and probably spread the virus that way. And so what we're looking forward to in the holiday season is a record number of people in the hospital, a record number of people being treated for this virus. And because there are so many people who need care in the hospital, there are a lot of hospital systems around the country that are now not admitting patients they would have admitted 2 or 3 months ago when they had more space. So, you know, in a real public health crisis, what ends up happening is more people die because of a virus than from the virus. And so in the case of Ebola in West Africa, you know, the health systems collapsed and people died of cholera and malaria and untreated AIDS and HIV, you know, things that ordinarily would be treated by a hospital system. You know, we all have this assumption that if something happens to us, if we have a stroke or a heart attack or get in a car wreck, that there's going to be a hospital bed to take care of us. that may not be the case in the next few months. And that's what really scares Redfield. That's what really scares the public health experts that I'm talking to around the country. And frankly, it really scares me, too.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Scott is with us in Madison. Scott, hi.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I'm a teacher and a parent in the Madison School District, and I'm just super concerned about the decisions that are being made, not based on science necessarily, but based on, like, public opinion. Like, the parents have been asked several times, like, what do you want to have happen? Do you want to have your kid back in school? That kind of question in the survey. And it's not based on if it's best for the kids, if there's, like, you know, if it's even ready in schools to keep them safe. I mean, what I've seen right now, it's not ready to have the distancing. And so I'm just very concerned that, like, when the numbers are getting higher and higher, they're still considering putting us back in school without necessarily the safety precautions for my kids and the kids I serve. And again, it's just, I just want it to be based on what's best, and science should be what we're looking at. And it shouldn't just be based on what people want. I know your guest said fatigue. Hey, I feel the fatigue too as a parent and a teacher. But to just say, like, I'll put them back in school, the kids are driving me crazy, is insane. Like, we're losing lives. We already lost a life of one of our kids who's 16 years old. I mean, he was in the Madison School District, but we weren't even in school, and he died of COVID. I mean, and it's not just the kids. I'm not as worried about the kids, but, like, if the kids are in school, they're going home to a family,
Scott,
and that family is going to be spreading it.
Thanks a lot for the call. I want to jump in. Scott hitting on one of the most, I think, contentious parts of government, state, local, district decision-making here, schools open or not.
Yeah, and Scott's wise to be concerned about it from both ends, really. I mean, one of the things that we're finding is that kids' educational attainment is taking a real hit in virtual learning. There are some of the wealthiest school districts in the country have just completely failed to understand virtual learning, or even the in-person part, if you do it safely, in a way that you could do it safely. We as a nation really didn't do a lot of the prep work in the spring and summer to get us ready for an opening. And as Scott mentioned, like, if you open schools, if you allow people to congregate, it does not matter how safe it's going to be. Somebody's going to get the virus. We have to, as a society, sort of understand what's the risk and trade-off of that. How many people getting sick is it worth reopening schools for? And let me tell you, I got a 4-year-old too, and I'm feeling exactly the same pressure. So I understand. I can only imagine what Scott's going through, worrying about being back in class himself. But of course, I mean, there is a trade-off here, and as a society, we decided we wanted to open bars and restaurants before we wanted to open schools.
Scott, thanks for that call. We're taking a look at some of the latest developments in the pandemic nationwide and state by state with Reed Wilson, correspondent at The Hill, author of the book Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about where the U.S. is at in the fight against COVID-19? Are you planning to get vaccinated the first chance that you can? Or are you going to take a wait-and-see approach? What do you think of President-elect Biden's call for Americans to wear masks for 100 days? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're taking a look at some of the latest news on COVID-19, including a surge in cases around the nation, upcoming vaccine distribution, new lockdown orders in California, and more. Reed Wilson is with us, correspondent at The Hill, author of Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on what you'd like to see when it comes to intervention by the state government, vaccine distribution, what should the priority be? Call in at 800-642-1234. Reed, let's talk about what's happening in some states when it comes to prevention measures. California, in particular, seeing some big news there. What's going on?
Yeah, California, the Bay Area, Los Angeles County, and I think San Diego has just joined them in renewing a stay-at-home order, echoing some of the strictest lockdowns of the first wave of the virus. And this is they're basing this on hospitalization metrics. So basically, if X percentage of hospital beds are full, then they lock down to try to stem the flow of the virus so that they can avoid overwhelming the hospital system. This is what everybody's concerned about, that notion of just a health system absolutely collapsing. We've seen some other states starting to open field hospitals, places like Rhode Island and Oklahoma City just opened one of theirs in a tent outside of a hospital in Oklahoma City. So this surge is starting to hit hospitals, and that is what's driving at least the lockdowns in California.
And President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, tested positive for COVID, being treated reportedly at a hospital in Washington. What do we know about his situation?
Well, so he tested positive at some point in the last few days. We don't know when. President Trump tweeted that he had tested positive last night. And within minutes, we figured out that he had been admitted to the Georgetown Medical Center over on the other side of town here. And this is concerning because Rudy Giuliani has been traveling the country making President Trump's case to overturn election results in places where they don't have any realistic ability to do so. He's just in the last couple of days, he's been in Georgia, he's been in Arizona, he's been in Michigan, and the Arizona State Legislature had so many of their members interact with Giuliani in the last couple of days that they have now shuttered the State House and the State Senate for a week to try to avoid any kind of outbreak among legislators there.
I had mentioned earlier, President-elect Biden said on CNN last week he wants all Americans to mask up as soon as he takes office. Here's a listen to what he had to say.
And I think my inclination, Jake, is on the first day I'm inaugurated to say I'm going to ask the public for 100 days to mask. Just 100 days to mask. Not forever, 100 days. And I think we'll see a significant reduction if we occur that, that occurs with vaccinations and masking, to drive down the numbers considerably.
So asking, not saying he will try to have any kind of federal mask mandate, which might be tough to pull out. What's been the reaction to his call there?
Well, I mean, it's a move that a lot of governors have made already, and most about half the states now have mask mandates in effect. Biden's touch, though, has got to be a little softer because he's coming into office at a time when we are riven by political differences effectively between the Trump fans and Biden fans. There is not a lot of room for common ground. Biden can't be the heavy-handed overarching. I don't want to say dictator, but you know, he can't be seen as imposing his will on a whole bunch of people who didn't vote for him. That's not going to be accepted, and that's probably going to drive those voters further away from the appropriate remedies that can solve this virus, or at least reduce transmission significantly. And you know, the studies show he's right. There have been something like a dozen studies on mask wearing and the spread of the coronavirus in just the last 6 or 8 months, and all of them have shown that it has a significant impact in reducing transmission. You can see that just in the bell curves of the case transmissions before and after some state implements a mask rule.
Let's go back to our callers now. Eddie is with us, driving a truck in Wisconsin. Eddie, hi.
Well, hello there.
What do you want to bring up, Eddie?
Well, I wanted to bring up the fact that no one's bringing up school teachers and the vaccinations for them. I believe that that's a very important topic that we need to bring up. No one has brought it up. I think that's they should definitely be one of the people that definitely get it first to open up our school system, for sure.
Eddie, thanks a lot for the call. And Reed, Eddie hitting on one of the next big issues, vaccine priority, who gets what first. Eddie making the case for teachers there. What is the state of the art when figuring out who gets the first rounds of vaccines?
Well, we gotta remember that the first rounds of vaccine are not going to be a huge number. They're going to be, you know, 10 million here, 20 million there, and these are two dose vaccines. So whatever number you hear, cut that in half, and that's the number of people who will be served. So pretty much everybody is on the same page that the two highest priority groups are the frontline healthcare workers who are, you know, in the room with COVID patients every day, and seniors, especially those who live in long-term care facilities where these outbreaks are not only have not only spread easily, but also have much higher mortality rates because those are the people who are most susceptible to this virus. And I'll give a little shout out to my city here, Washington, D.C. Teachers are next on the list in the D.C. priority. And I know that a lot of other states are putting teachers really high on that list. So that sort of the secondary who gets it after the frontline workers and those older people in long-term care facilities, that's the debate that's going to happen at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta and in a lot of cities and states across the country. The CDC does the recommending, but it's up to the states to actually implement that and distribute the vaccine based on who what their priorities are. I got to tell you, Rob, you and I, we're essential workers. We could go towards the front as journalists, but I don't think that would go over terribly well.
I can isolate myself pretty well from humanity. I think I should probably be pretty low on the list. I can lock myself in a room and do my job. So that's not so bad. Time for one more caller. Sarah with us in Zion, Illinois. Sarah, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Sarah?
Okay. Yeah, I'm down in Illinois, and I'm really hyped up right now because I was just at the grocery store. And people in my town they used to take it seriously. They used to have their mask on. And now, like, employees, it was like halfway on and people's noses were sticking out. And this one employee just didn't even have it on. And it just really, really worries me because this is going to happen in the near future. People are getting so blasé. I just don't understand it. I just recovered from COVID. I got it and died.
Sarah, you're breaking up, and I'm sorry. It sounds like you just had COVID, and I hope you're recovering okay. But Sarah, making the case, read that in our last minute, we're slacking on our efforts to stop COVID just as it's getting really bad again.
Right, and this is the fatigue that we were talking about in the beginning here. This is the light is there at the end of the tunnel. We can get to the end. We just have to make sure that we get through the rest of the tunnel. Mask usage is way up across the country, and it's an easy intervention to stop this virus. We should all just do it, keep our heads down, and get through this last little stretch together.
Sarah, thanks for the call. And Reed, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
We've been talking to Reed Wilson, correspondent at The Hill, author of the book Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. We talked with him about the surge in COVID-19 cases nationwide, vaccine distribution, the CDC, and more. What does hope look like to you? That's a question the city of Appleton is asking as part of a contest looking for photos that will appear on the Houdini Welcome Plaza Tower. Karen Harkness is Director of Community and Economic Development for the City of Appleton. Karen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, before we get into the contest, tell us about the Houdini Plaza and this Welcome Tower. Set the stage for us here.
I'd love to. So the Houdini Tower is part of our Houdini Plaza, which was recreated in 2013 and 2014. It really acts as our city's front porch. It's located right in our central business district. And in pre-pandemic times, it's hustling and bustling with events every weekend and several nights of the week.
And have you been featuring local artists and photographers there for a while now?
We have been featuring local artists and photographers since the redevelopment of the plaza in 2013 and 2014. Our very first exhibit was a tribute to Harry Houdini, as is the entire plaza itself. A lot of allegoric meaning throughout the plaza. For instance, the diagonal walking trail that runs directly through the middle of the plaza is a chain link out of the bricks. And that's to commemorate his famous chain tricks that he did. He would be able to get out of any handcuffs and any chains. And although Harry Houdini claimed to have been born in April 1874 in Appleton, he actually was born in Budapest, Hungary. But Harry Houdini always claimed Appleton as his hometown.
And he grew up there, to be fair, right?
He did grow up here, yes.
Now, you've got this contest now looking for local photographs. What was the inspiration here?
So the inspiration was twofold. The inspiration was trying to find images of hope during a very trying year for many people. The pandemic has impacted people with their jobs, with deaths or sickness of loved ones. We are very acutely aware of the shadow pandemic or the higher use of alcohol and drugs, increase in suicide. And we really, really felt like images of hope depicting areas, pictures taken in and around Appleton that represented hope in this uncertain times was important. Also, Appleton Downtown Incorporated, in partnership with some other businesses, placed 4-foot letters creating the word hope, H-O-P-E, along the side of the Houdini Tower, Welcome Tower. So the two kind of go hand in hand, Rob.
And now, how many winning photos are we going to end up with here at the tower?
So we will be selecting 12 winning photographs. There are 12 display boxes in the tower, three on each of the four sides. They're backlit inside, Rob, so at night the colors just really pop. They're beautiful images, whether you're able to see them in the daytime or in the evening. So 12 winning photographs will be displayed in the Houdini Plaza Welcome Tower for a minimum of 6 months. And the Appleton Arts Committee, which is made up of 5 community members, will actually do that choice. They'll pick who those 12 winners are. And the winners will each win a $100 prize and a $25 downtown Appleton gift card. Each contestant can submit up to 3 photographs that can be qualified for the selection. And as of this afternoon, Rob, we had 29 images that had already been given to us.
And what's the deadline for local people who want to get into the contest?
Submissions are due by December 18th.
Okay, so they should get on that. Now, when you imagine the people participating, are you thinking, you know, these are the local professional photographers? Or are you hoping that anybody gets in and gives it a try?
That's a great question too, Rob. We want to open it up to any Appleton resident, regardless of their age or their skill level. And, you know, hope means something different to everyone. So we don't have a preconceived idea of what those photographs and images can look like. So we are really excited to see what we get from the community.
And is, you know, it might be a while after this before we can congregate at the tower and see these in person. There's going to be an online display for all of these that we can all check out.
There absolutely will be, Rob. We will be posting those on our page. We'll be putting them out on Facebook. And to your point, whether you're able to see them in person by driving by or walking with social distancing and masking throughout the plaza, we want everybody to be able to see these community images and take a look at those photographs and relate those back to your own images of hope during this trying time.
And as we wrap up, Karen, could you just talk a little bit about the value of having, you know, art like this up in public, getting the community involved in creating a positive time for the community?
Oh my gosh, Rob, I could go on and on about that. You know, art brings our community together. Art speaks to us individually. We all see our own story as we look at that particular photograph. It sparks conversation. It enlivens our community. It drives people to those restaurants, those retail establishments that are located nearby, or even right now just to get outside and breathe some fresh air, see a different perspective than your home. It's so important.
Karen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Karen Harkness is Director of Community and Economic Development for the City of Appleton. We talked to her today about a photo contest there where the city is looking for images that represent hope to feature on their Houdini Plaza Welcome Tower. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about family.
The connection between a grandmother and her granddaughter is special, especially when it's bound by braids. Writer Araceli Esparza tells us more about it in the story Braided Life or Vida de Trenzas.
Everyone, everywhere, wears their hair differently, but not me. My braids, I wear them every day because I like it that way. I wear a braid like me mama, and she wears her braid like her mama, my grandmother. Braids are familia, but some days with all of its twists and turns, I wish to lose or cut it short. Monday, Lunes. Mama, why do we wear braids? Quetzali asks. Braids are who we are, mija. I wear braids. Abuelita wears braids. Braids are like family. We are family every day. I don't want to wear my braids anymore. I want to be like everyone else with short or curly hair and be me. Tuesday, Martes. At school, I see wavy hair, corn-rolled hair, twisted hair, and even colored hair. I want to snap my trenzas away, but when I touch them, they remind me what Mama said, and I walk on. Wednesday, Miércoles. In front of a mirror, I comb my hair up. Maybe like this. I tease it sideways or like this to make new hair and a new me. Thursday, Jueves. Abuelita, when I go to the tienda, there's short, spiky, and long hair, but my trenzas are woven. At the dress shop, I see round, soft, fluffy hair, but my braids are pulled tight. At the Fix-It store, I see slick and shiny hair, but my braids hang down. You're right, Quetzali. Everyone wears their hair differently, says Abuelita. Friday, Viernes. Our hair connects us to where we work, who we are, and where we come from, Abuelita tells me on the way to the park. I run, but my braids make me slow to chase, or too big to go under, and after a while, my braids are like two matted fighting cats. Saturday, Sábado. Abuelita, the kids at school yanked on my trenzas, and sometimes my braids get in the way of having fun. Gently, she sits me up on the chair and begins to part my hair. I understand, Quetzali. Sometimes when people see trenzas, they wish to have one, and because they don't have one, they feel that teasing is the only way. Abuelita, if I cut my hair, will I still be familia? Ay, Quetzali, familia is familia, always. Remember, if you do cut your hair, it will grow back. Sunday, Domingo. Sitting in the salon with pinned up hair, ready for my haircut, I see me without my long, strong hair. And I see me, lonely and plain. With a twirl, I stop her scissor hands and I make my braids like propellers. And with a whoosh, I'm in the air. Zoom, zoom, between backyards and from playgrounds and rooftops, I see all these people with shiny, brown, braided hair like me, looking royal and proud. My braids, I wear them every day because I like it that way. Y mientras dejo tu trenza, imagino cuando crezcas.
Araceli Esparza is a writer based in Madison and host of the podcast Midwest Mujeres. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
If I were to ask you whether you thought the pandemic has made Americans more or less generous, what would you say? Millions of people lost jobs or had their hours cut. Some are still waiting for unemployment assistance. And it's anybody's guess what the future holds for COVID-19 and the economy. So it might make sense that people would keep a little tighter hold on their wallets. But our next guest says the overall trend is that people are actually giving more, at least according to some early data. She says charitable organizations with an obvious connection to the pandemic are getting lots of donations. Some groups doing non-pandemic related work, though, have faced a tough year. Sigal Samuel is a staff writer for Vox's Future Perfect. She writes about artificial intelligence, neuroscience, ethics, and the intersection of technology and religion. She's the author of the novel The Mystics of Mile End. Sigal, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, with the exception that a lot of giving happens still in December, we won't have final numbers for a while. What do we know so far when it comes to how much people are giving?
So far, it really looks like the overall trend line for charitable giving this year is up. Giving Tuesday, which is the movement that encourages us all to refocus on doing good and giving after we all have our post-Thanksgiving shopping blitz. It's December 1st every year. They reported that total giving increased from $1.9 billion to $2.4 billion in the U.S. alone. That's a 25% increase compared to last year, which is pretty good. And also we saw that 56% of U.S. households gave to charity or volunteered in response to the pandemic. And we also saw that in the first half of this year, there was a 12.6% increase in the number of new donors to charity compared to a year ago. So you're seeing both an increase in how much people are giving, but you're also really hearteningly seeing people who weren't donors before suddenly feeling moved to become donors and start giving to charity as they see what the pandemic is doing to everybody.
And it sounds like from those numbers you gave, it can't statistically be just wealthy people stepping up giving during this tough year. It must involve a lot of people with lower incomes still making donations. Do I have that right?
That's right. You know, I personally find some of the most heartening donations that you see are actually donations of, you know, 50 cents, $1, which sometimes come from people who are incarcerated or experiencing homelessness and are still really motivated to give. In fact, the people who gave most to hunger relief were actually people who had lost their jobs this year due to the pandemic. So it's often people who are most hurting from economic downturns or tragedies that feel most compelled to give because they know what it feels like to be in need.
You write that there is one trouble spot for some organizations that rely on big event fundraisers. Obviously, that's got to be hit hard by COVID-19. How much of a strain is that putting on these groups?
Yeah, it's been a really big problem. A lot of the nonprofits that do super important work but are not related to COVID per se are really getting left out of the funding. And so, you know, this is all the sorts of charities that rely on galas and auctions and in-person fundraisers to make their money every year. So they've really been hit hard. And one reflection of that is the fact that at least 1 million nonprofit workers in the U.S. lost their jobs this year because of the pandemic.
We're talking to Sigal Samuel from Vox. She wrote about donations in the United States in the year of the COVID-19 pandemic. According to a lot of the data out there, we're giving more, not less, in a year that's been difficult for our health and for our economy. And Sigal, you write that this runs counter to what a lot of people might think about how we react in the face of hardship or disaster, the idea that we're going to get selfish, we're going to take care of ourselves first. Can you talk about what we think and what seems to actually happen?
Sure. So there are two basic stories people like to tell about how human beings behave in times of crisis. Story number one says people just panic. They start ignoring social norms. They just behave selfishly. Look out for number one. Story number two says, actually, no, people are really generous in the wake of a disaster. They donate, they volunteer. The first narrative is what you typically see in media coverage. But actually, the second narrative, if you look to the historical record, it has a lot of data behind it. You really see a lot of generosity in the wake of earthquakes, terrorist attacks, hurricanes, and now a pandemic. So I myself used to be more cynical about this and assume that when times are tough, people really clamp down on their limited resources and have a scarcity mentality. But I've kind of changed my mind as I've looked at more of the data, and it's made me more optimistic.
Do you see the media reinforcing that idea of the, I guess, the selfish reaction, I guess, the Walking Dead scenario where we take care of ourselves during the zombie attack versus what's really happening? Can the media do a better job covering these things?
Absolutely. I think we in the media have to do a better job of this. One example that always jumps out at me is the way a New York Times article described New Orleans in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. Described the city as, quote, a snake pit of anarchy, death, looting, raping, marauding thugs. That's really bleak and makes you have one picture of New Orleans. But in fact, in the wake of Katrina, most people there were peaceful and helpful to each other. So I think we need to do a better job of giving that fuller picture.
Now, as we said, the year is not quite done yet. I know people talk about fatigue with COVID. Are there worries that the run of what looks like an outburst of generosity might fizzle out as this keeps rolling on?
Yes. So we have seen from some surveys that at the beginning of the pandemic in March, April, there was a really big uptick in giving. And then that somewhat tapered off a little bit, you know, as we got into the summer, into the fall. But I'm really hopeful that this month we'll see another huge spike in giving. Typically, 30% of total annual giving happens in December, and something like 12% is in the last 3 days of December as people remember, oh, I better quickly make my end of year tax deductible donations. So I'm hopeful that we will see a lot of donations coming in the next couple weeks.
And we've been talking about money in particular. A lot of people, of course, like to volunteer or give in that kind of way. That can be tougher, of course, when it's hard to gather in person. Do we know much about how we're donating things like our time and talent?
Yeah, people are really, really eager to volunteer. I think one beautiful way that's been done is people early on in the pandemic started creating these mutual aid spreadsheets where they just put down their names, their contact info, and offers to bring medications or groceries to vulnerable people in their neighborhoods. There's a lot of other ways to volunteer. You can find some of them listed on the Gates Foundation's new website, powerof.org. It aggregates a lot of nice opportunities for volunteering. But I also would just like to say, think about, it's worth thinking about what even a small amount of cash can do if you're in a relatively wealthy country, such as the US, where, you know, $1 or $2 or $3 may not go very far over here. But in certain African countries, for example, it can go way farther. And so it's worth looking at charities like GiveDirectly, for example, which raises money and gives cash transfers directly to individuals in need in African countries where people are suffering from the pandemic, and our money can go really, really far there.
We'll leave it there. Thank you, Sigal, so much for joining us and sharing this with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks again.
Sigal Samuel is a staff writer for Vox's Future Perfect. We talked to her about how the pandemic, along with job losses and economic uncertainty, may actually be making people in the United States more generous, not less. Hey, this is a good time to thank you for all of your support during our year-end member drive last week. We heard from so many of you. Really do appreciate your support for the work we do here on the Ideas Network. We can't do it without you. So again, thank you.